Okay, so we're going to do Sefer Bamidbar, hopefully in an hour, the whole thing. So, everybody's all scattered around. All right, so Bamidbar. So you said last time that it always goes by the either important principle or the first important word in the book. That's why it's named that. This was named by principle first. It used to be called the Book of Counting, or Sefer Pikudim, Book of Remembering, but it, which is why it's called Numbers. Oh, here we go. Hello, welcome, take a seat. Have a seat. Which is why it's called Numbers in English. No problem. Just want to respect the on-timeness of the ones who were on time.
You sure?
Yeah, he's fine.
Mazel tov.
Well, thank you. We have a new
dancer. Oh, nice. Mazel tov.
Which is very exciting.
Yeah, sure.
Are you going for the dress?
Yes.
On Thursday. San Francisco, right?
San Francisco.
Very nice.
So that's very soon.
Yeah, yeah.
Mazel tov.
Around this.
That's okay.
Yes, we have an announcement to make.
It's so exciting. What number is this for you, Leah and Hara? We should count. Four, very nice. May there be many more. Continue and grow.
I'm very happy with what we've done.
Well, there could be many more from them. No, not from your kids, from their kids. You know,
meaning, kids and kids.
That's right. May there be many more. May your family continue to expand and expand.
Yeah.
So.
Nature is like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, so we're talking about Bamidbar. The name of the book is called Bamidbar, which in English is Numbers. So Bamidbar, we said at first it was named in Hebrew even after the numbers, the counting. There's a lot of counting going on in this book. So counting and remembering and looking into and counting and delineating. So at first it was named that, and that is what its name is in English. And but really it settled into being the name Bamidbar in the desert. So this book is continuing in the desert. So really it's the end, right here, the end of parenthesis. Really the book that we looked at last week was a book sort of that was in parenthesis. Because it was a parenthetical stop in the narrative of the journey, really. There's just, we stop for a lot of laws. Now we continue with the story. So so what's going on here in the desert? Why do we get the Torah in the desert? Anybody know?
We started off there.
Okay, fine. So, why? But God could have taken us out of Egypt and sent us anywhere.
Because we were slaves there, and it was hard for slave people to become free people again.
Mm-hmm.
That journey in the desert sort of cleansed us of all the sins of Egypt and made us better people, so we were ready to go to the promised land.
Mm-hmm. Good, okay, great.
They took the wrong path.
They took the wrong path, good. Yes, they did.
They took the wrong path also.
The slaves had a slave mentality.
Mentality, uh-huh. That's what I've been saying.
It had to be.
Had to be taken out.
Taken
right.
Out and purged.
So what else about deserts? Think about deserts for a minute. Just think about the difference between the cities in this area. Think about how different Denver is from Boulder, from Cheyenne, from Taos, from Pueblo. They're all very different flavors. Each city has its own character, right? But in between, sometimes you drive, like I just recently drove to Nebraska. There's a lot of empty in between here and where the kosher slaughterhouses are in Nebraska. You know, a lot of empty. So the Torah was given in the middle of the empty. And part of it is because the whole desert experience was about creating the culture of who we would become. So it had to be given outside the culture of anything else. Outside the culture of any other city or any other flavor, in a flavorless zone of desert without anything contributing except for the people who are there and their relationship with God. So that we have that time to receive the Torah in the middle of nothingness to help us. So really the desert was a 40-year workshop. We'll talk about that in a minute. But a 40-year workshop in creating culture before we went into the land of Israel. Right, so that's what we're doing, is culture creation in the middle of nowhere. So we start by counting. It's interesting, the last book, Leviticus, ended with a counting. It ended with the counting of the sheep for the animal tithes. And each of those sheep were counted one by one by one. They all had to go through a little hole. I don't remember if we talked about that last week, or if it was in a different class where I teach them mitzvahs. Yeah, so it's interesting. When you count the sheep in order to tithe them, you could just say, I have 100 sheep, 10 will go to the tithing, right? But you can't do it that way. You can't just like pick your 10 or cordon off the 10. You have to actually put the 100 lambs, goats and lambs go together, behind a wall with a little opening that only one can go through at a time. Then you put the moms on the other side. And the mothers make the noises calling the children. And then the lambs and goats arrange themselves to go through the hole one by one. And you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, strike, and count again. So they arrange themselves, and they make themselves into the order, and you count to 10 each time, and put a red stripe on each one every time you get to 10, and it's those that are the tithe. So and there's a lot of reasons for that, but one reason is because it's kind of hard to give away 10% of your stuff. You just like take that 10%. But if you first count the 9 that's for you, 1 for me, 2 for me, 3 for me, 4 for me, 5 for me, 6 for me, 7 for me, 8 for me, 9 for me, okay, 1 for God, 1 for me, 2 for me. It's a lot easier to do it that way. So, and plus then there's no, you don't like say, oh, I'll take the nice one, I'll give the not as nice one, or I want only the nice ones. It's all random, just goes by however God wants it to go, however the animals arrange themselves to go through that hole. So that's the end of the last book. The beginning of this book is the counting of people. The bridge is more than just the counting. It's the counting of individuals. That individuals matter. So with the sheep, each one is counted one by one. And in the beginning of this book, we're counted one by one as well. There's a one by one counting to show that individuals matter. When we're counted individually, and then we're also counted by, and then we're named by our family, our tribe, and then part of the nation. To really show all those subdivisions. We're all here to be part of a nation. And we matter as part of the nation. But we also matter as individuals. Each family is different. Each tribe is different. So we see the difference in the uniqueness and individuality of each person. And then hopefully adding that into the collective power of us together for the sake of one nation. But that we do have room for differences. We're supposed to have room for differences. There's lots of different things that we don't actually put into practice too much today, but it's important to see that the room for differences that we have. So we have a tradition that initially there are 12 different prayer books. Today we basically have 2 or 3, and I don't mean Reformed, Conservative, Orthodox, and within the traditional prayer set. So there's the Art Scroll, what? Art Scroll Ashkenazic, Art Scroll Sephardic. Right, that's basically it, or Art Scroll Sephard, which is a brand of Ashkenaz. So we basically have 3 today. Within the Sephardic world, there's 1 or 2 more. But there used to be 12, one for each tribe. They were all different, because each tribe had their own way of connecting. So there's even a tradition, it's just a midrash, and whether it's true or not, it still teaches. We don't take midrash as true. We take what they teach as true. But we say it as stories that are true, but it's really the essence that's true. So there's a midrash that says there are 12, when the sea split, there are 12 tunnels, one for each tribe to go through, meaning each tribe could find its own way, its own dry land going through the sea, its own pathway to the other side. That there are lots of different appropriate pathways that we could all walk on in different ways and still get to the same destination of connection. Okay, so the counting. So the counting is also about belonging, that we all belong to one nation. And that's I mean, we know that as Jews, we talked about, I think, last time about the mum plant, you know, and all the different blossoms, and right, we talked about that, and the one root. So it's we have a phrase, you, Jews, are called Adam. So some people say, what does that mean? Only Jews are called human beings in our tradition? Is that what it means? We only think of ourselves as human beings and not as others as human beings? And so a rabbi came to say, no, actually, it's, no, we don't think that we're, and some people do, in a prejudicial way, look at it that way. He says, no, that's not actually the way to think about it. We're called Adam. We're called one person. Because as a group, we are one person. When we think about Gilad Shalit, right, when he was taken captive, who didn't pray for him among the Jewish people? He was our brother, our son, our nephew, right? All of us, we all cared about him, and we all were worried about him, and we were all happy when he was released. So we're one person. We're Adam, one person, because we have that cohesiveness. I don't remember if I mentioned so many classes I teach. A lot of people ask me when I converted, what did your parents say? So Protestants don't ask that question, because there's so many Protestants, it doesn't matter if there's one more or one less, right? Jews really care if their kid marries out or not, or if you have another grandson. It's great! It's another member of the Jewish people. How fabulous is that? We count each one. Each one matters. Each one is precious to us. You know, I mean, it's nice for another family, a Catholic family, a Protestant family, to have another child. Great for them. But it's not like, terrific, there's one more Catholic on the planet. I'm thrilled about that. No, we have a special nation, and we really care about each other. And we want there to be another Jewish child among us. We care about each one. Okay. Now let's look down here at camp, right? So what was going on? The camp of Israel. I drew a little picture. It's not big enough for you to see. On the back of here. No, it's only on the back of my paper, sorry. Because I was just thinking about it. I should have drawn it on the back
of yours.
So how did they set up the camp? Okay, so now the Jews are in the desert, and they've gotten some rules, and they've built the sanctuary, and now they're all set up as a camp. So you have the Mishkan, the tabernacles, in the center. Around that, you have the tents of the Levites, and around that, you have the 12 tribes. So wait a second. 12 tribes... There's 12 around, and the Levites in the middle. There's actually, in a way, 13 tribes. There's really 13. It's really 12, but it's 13. We talk about the 12 tribes, but how'd that work? Who had two? Yosef had two. So the one of Yosef, of Joseph, was replaced by his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. So in the end, we get 13. So the Levitical tribe doesn't count, really, in terms of possession of the land. It doesn't count in the division of the 12. So the Levites are the servants, the sacred servants, really, and from them there's the subdivision of the Kohanim. So we have the Levites around the center, and then the rest of the tribes arranged around that. And they are arranged in a certain order. So to the north, you don't have to remember this, but just so you know, the north we have three, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. To the east, Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zebulun. To the south, Reuven, Shimon, and Gad. And to the, what's that side? That's east, that's west. Ephraim, Manasseh, and Binyam. A little dyslexic. So that's how they're arranged. And some people say that the whole camp actually moved that way. That they all just like picked up their stakes and moved in the same shape that they were. So but now that the camp is arranged, or that they moved differently and then they recamped themselves, but they had that order of encampment wherever they encamped. There's a lot of encamping and decamping and encamping and decamping in this book. 42, I think, different places, which we'll get to. But meanwhile, the camp was arranged that way. Once the camp is arranged, so there's an inner camp, a middle camp, a main camp, and an outside the camp zone, right? So inner camp, the temple, the tabernacle, mid camp, the Levitical circle, main camp, the rest of the tribes, and then outside of that. So now there's laws. Now that we know how the camp is set up, there's laws about who gets outside the three rings, right? So there are three different levels of tumah. Did we talk about tumah and tara last time? I don't remember. A little bit. Tumah is, I think we did. Tumah is related to death. Tahara is related to life. Tahara is energy of connection, spiritual connectivity, productivity, creativity, growth. Tumah is the closing down of that potential to different degrees. So, but it's related to death from the slightest little thing like dead skin cells on your fingernails if you scratch your scalp, all the way up to a dead Jewish body is the most tummy thing. So tiny little tummy things, a dead mouse, all the way up to a dead human body. So there's a spectrum of tumah that's there. There's quite a few things that can produce tumah. One of them is coming to contact with a dead body. One of them is having... life energy exit your body, so that could be menstruation, that could be giving birth, or that could be what's called zav. It's a flow from the sexual organs of either males or females. That's a not healthy flow, and that's spiritually not healthy flow, not a physically not healthy flow. So that can render somebody temporarily in a state of tumah. It's a mid-level tumah. Or there's a third level of tumah that applies here, which is the tumah of having spoken lashon hara, negative speech about another Jew, which would make at that time, not at this time, could, and I'm using the wrong word here because we don't have a word, I'll say it first in Hebrew, makes somebody a metzora. We translate that word in English incorrectly as leprous. It's not leprosy. So, however, it does manifest physically as a skin lesion, white patches on the skin. And once somebody, so the way it worked at that time is if the person would speak negatively, and then there would be manifestations on their skin of the spiritual malady that they caused themselves, that would be coming out physically. And then they'd bring their skin over to the Kohen, who would look at it and say, yeah, that's it. Once it's confirmed by the Kohen, so it has to appear physically, be shown to a Kohen, confirmed by the Kohen. Once it is, that person kicked out of the camp for 7 days. Why? It's the only tumah that's not associated with death. Or is it? Right? So death, if you think about it, is the end of potential for connection. Lashon Hara attempts to disconnect a person, speaking evilly about another, attempts to disconnect them from the group. Do you know what she did? Do you know what he wore? Do you know what they gave? Do you know what they, whatever it is, right? Whatever that is, the attempt is to cut them out of the group of people and remove them from it. So you're disconnected by your speech. So the healing for that, the spiritual healing for that, is you have to feel disconnected. Know what it is to not be a part of the group. Out you go from the whole camp. It's the only one that you have to be removed from the whole thing. The other ones are removed from certain inner circles, but they're still with people, they can talk. But the one who speaks Lashon Hara and gets that spiritual leprosy is out for a whole week where they get to contemplate being alone. If they return, if they regret and repent and successfully cure themselves, and then bring their skin back to the Kohen, who looks at it and can tell by the physical look, yes, you did the right amount of spiritual work, now you can go to the mikvah. They go to the mikvah, they can rejoin. And if not, 7 days more, let them work on it a little longer. So that's the one that goes out of the camp altogether. The person who's tamei meit, the person who came into contact with the dead body, just can't go into the central part, the middle part. And the middle ones, the ones who had that flow exit their body, a life energy flow exit their body, they can't go into the Levitical camp, but they can go into the whole rest of the camp. So what is that? That is about removing spiritual disconnectivity from our midst. So it's a physical law. We have to remove it. And so it's a law on us, the group, take it out. And it's a law on each one of us, the individual, don't go in. So if I have it, I can't go in. If you see me with it, you have to tell me. You have to leave. Right? So it's on both of us. But it's also allegorical that we have three parts of a camp within us, right? We have our inner sanctum, our middle area, and our outer main camp. So our inner sanctum is our brain, that which really connects with God. That's what we're thinking about, right? What we have inside our thoughts. And then past our flashes of thoughts and connectivity is emotions. That's like the Levitical camp that surrounds the brain. And then past that is our actions, right? That's the stuff of our daily life, how we behave. And we want to also send disconnectivity away from each three of the camps. For sure, we don't want it in our actions. But we don't really even want it in our emotions that we would desire to do something that disconnects us. But if we could try to not even get it into our thoughts, a fleeting thought, that would be best, that we should try to keep it away from that. Which is why some people are careful about movies that they watch or magazines that they read. I remember once, I try not to read super negative stuff, but I remember once I was reading the Smithsonian, I was pregnant, and I read a very interesting article on the plague, three different types of plague that there were, and what it was like in Europe, and how terrible it was, because some people knew they were sick, sneeze, and a week later they're dead. Some people just drop dead like that, and there was no warning, right? And some people got sick and died. So there are three different types. But there were those who just dropped it. So I mentioned it, and that's what the children's song is, ring around the rosy, pocket full of posy, ashes, ashes, we all fall down. It's from the plague. Mm-hmm. Ring around the rosy, you get a sign on your cheek. You got rosy cheeks, right? Ring around the rosy, pocket full of posy. People carry pockets full of fragrant flowers because of all the dead bodies and the stench. Ashes, ashes, they burn them. We all fall down. Everybody dies. That's the song. Not a good one to sing to your kids. So, yeah, so it's a plague song. Right, so I mentioned this to my Torah teacher. She said, Aliza, what are you reading? You're pregnant. You shouldn't be putting that into your mind right now. So I started on a journey at that time, learning that there are things to be more careful about. What do we introduce into our minds? What do we want to cause ourselves to think about? What's the ingredients of our thoughts, and what do we want to put there? You know, I often think about it when I look at the morning paper. Sometimes the picture's terrible. We need to see that picture above the fold while you're eating breakfast. You know, so I'll turn that over and look at that personal section of the journal or whatever, but you don't need to see a yucky picture of whatever just got exploded or something while you're having breakfast. That's not healthy to put into you with your food. So these are thoughts, and just one more thought on that. I know Rabbi Friedman of the Yeshiva, when he teaches the boys about what to think about and what not to think about and how it might manifest in their behavior, right, of what boys do at that age in yeshiva. So he says, you can't prevent a bird from flying over your head, but you can prevent it from making a nest in your hair, right? Meaning, can't always help the thoughts that pop in, but if you fantasize about them, that's a nest, and that's up to you. You get to pick if you do or not. So chase it away before it builds a nest.
What about the girls?
Girls too, but boys are much more at that age.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Then moving right along in the book, it discusses the priestly duties and the Levitical duties. So first of all, the Levitical duties. So at first, when the nation was newly forming, and we're still in the new stages, but new, it was the firstborns that had the privilege of being the main servants of the people and of God, the liaison between God and the people. And in fact, it's an interesting concept. We, the Jews, are called the firstborn of God. The Jewish people are called the firstborn nation. But clearly we're not. There were other nations before us. So it's interesting. Firstborn in Hebrew is called the Bechor, the firstborn. And we are the chosen people, the Bachar, right? Asher Bachar Banu, right? And he chose us from among the nations. Bachar, Bachor, very similar sounding. It's a chet and a chaf difference, but the sound is the same. We're the Am HaNivchar, the chosen people. Bachor, the firstborn. So that is put together. So what is it about being the firstborn? So initially, the firstborns were the ones who did what the Kohanim do today. Because the firstborn's role in a family, any firstborns in this room? You are? Do you have, how many siblings do you have?
Two.
Two? This one. I just have one also. I don't know if it's quite the same with one. It might be more with two. But certainly with a lot, right? So let's just imagine a family of four, five, six, whatever it is. The firstborn is like a mini parent. They're the go-between, the liaison between parents and children. I see that with my daughter-in-law. She has a five-year-old firstborn and then a three and a two. The three, though, has Down syndrome, so it's like two twos, really. So when she talks to him, she says, we'll put the babies to bed, and then you and I will. Whatever it is, it's the babies and him, right? So the firstborn is the junior parent, the one who understands the parents best out of the other kids, and the one who understands the kids and can bring concerns back and forth. That's the role of the firstborn, is to help the kids do what the parent wants and help the parent understand what the kids need. So the liaison. So in that sense, we are the firstborn of the nations. It is our job to be like the oldest. All the nations are our younger brothers and sisters, but it's our job to be the liaison between our heavenly parent and the other kids, that we're the go-betweens, and we're the ones who have to set the example and bear the torch for how all the kids should behave in the family. Hopefully we'll get back to that in a minute. So we are, let's see. Then after the firstborns, then the sin of the golden calf. That job was snatched away from the firstborns as they participated in the sin of the golden calf along with everybody else, so they're no longer worthy of the task. The only ones who refrained from participating in the sin of the golden calf were? Who knows?
Women
and which men?
The Levites.
That's right. The women and the Levites. So all the men, no more firstborns in it. Now the women don't get punished with that, but the Levites did not behave in it. So now the priestly duties go to the Levites. Later on in the book, we're probably not going to really discuss it, but there's a whole situation with Pinchas, and Pinchas exhibits a zealotry, and so he's a Levite. As a reward for that, it's the whole subset of priestly class goes through Pinchas. It's only his descendants that are the Kohanim, a subset of the Levites, and that's how it is today. But we have the priestly duties mentioned here. So one, of course, is doing the service in the temple, including all the offerings. But there's two more here to discuss, which is, another one we talked about, checking out the metzora, to see if they have, you know, the skin lesions, what they are, if they are diagnosing. Another one is the priestly blessing, becoming a channel for the blessing of God to the people. And that's in this book, is that threefold blessing. And another one is lighting the menorah. Lighting the menorah is an interesting one. That follows directly after a section of the princes of the tribes, the leaders of each tribe, bringing their tribe's offering to the tabernacle. And it's a very interesting section, because we do have this principle that there's no extra words in the Torah. So this section is long and repetitious. Each tribe brings exactly the same thing, and it's a whole paragraph-long discussion of what they bring, and then it's repeated. So it basically says, and the tribe of Dan brought, blah, 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 and it goes and describes the entire thing, and the next day, the tribe of Naphtali brought exactly the same thing. It could say, each tribe brought this, Dan on the first day, Naphtali on the second day, God on the third day. No, it doesn't say that. Each one, it goes to the entire thing. So we'll get back to that in 1 second. But after that, the Levites are not one that had to bring an offering. Because they're not. They are working in the temple. So they might feel a little bit bad that, like, everybody else got to bring something. We didn't. So what, right after that description, is the description of the menorah service. Oh, you guys can get to bring the offering, but here's your service that's for the Levites, the Kohanim, really. Subset of the Levites, but they're part of the whole same tribe. And this is a service, actually this offering goes forever. Because you get to light the menorah now, but the Jewish people will continue to light it even after there's not a temple anymore. That the kindling of the lights of the menorah is an eternal thing that goes on. So you get to start it now in the temple, and it will continue on in the generations. One reason why they say the same offering again and again and again and again is to show our unity. So one is, we all gave exactly the same thing. We weren't into trumping one over the other. We didn't have to outdo the one behind us, try to think of something extra. We each brought the same thing. But the other thing to show is that it's really the kavanah, really the thought that accompanies it, that makes each one different. Each offering physically was the same, but it was imbued by the thoughts and gifts and wishes of each person, so it made it differently, different. So each offering, so imagine a guy standing on the street corner selling flowers, you know, for Friday afternoon or whatever it is, Mother's Day, all those bouquets of roses are the same. But once you buy it and give it to your person, it's totally different than the ones that are left behind because you have your thoughts and feelings. One person gives it as an I'm sorry, one person gives it as an I love you, one person gives it as Mom, thanks so much. You know, each one is completely different depending on the thoughts that are in it, even though each one's a dozen red roses. One of the other things that are in here, which I'll just say quickly, one of the Kohanim's job was to work with the sota. I'm trying to think how they said it in English. Like the order of jealousy or something like that. There is a procedure for a suspected adulterous wife. It's not a pleasant procedure. And it's not just a little suspect either. It bothered me a lot as I heard about it over the years. Suspected of adultery, and she has to now go into the temple and uncover her hair in public and have it tussled. It's actually from there that we learned that married Jewish women cover their hair. Because here, this married woman's hair is uncovered. So that's how we get a biblical source for the covering. But they uncover her hair and make her a little disheveled, and then they take God's name, write it on a piece of parchment, dissolve it into bitter waters, and she drinks it. If she's guilty, she and the person that she was adulterous with, wherever he is, both of their stomachs explode and they die. If she's innocent, everything's fine, and she's blessed, and she conceives and has babies. And, okay, that's the basic procedure. Now, I always thought it's so not fair. What do you mean you just suspect her and subject this to this embarrassing ritual? Right? But it's not just suspect. She has to be seen going into seclusion with a man that the husband suspects her about. So, and then he has to warn her. He says, I don't want to see you going alone with Bob ever again. And then first she's warned. So you see, she's warned, and then she and Bob, in front of two witnesses, go behind closed doors and lock it so that they have privacy. You don't have to actually see what they do, but once it's clear with witnesses that they were alone in private after she was warned, that's when she's suspected. And that's when she can be taken to the temple to do this, only after that. So we don't know what she did, but there is real room for suspicion because she was seen, she was did bother her husband, she was warned, and then she did this in front of witnesses, so now the whole thing. So the Kohen administers that ceremony too, the Sota ceremony. Apparently, just parenthetically, it stopped working after some period of time. I don't know the whole history of it, but even during temple times they stopped doing it. So I can't really comment on that, just throwing that out there for general information. File it away. You'll hear something else about it someday. Okay. So now we have everybody and the order of people and what's in the camps and what people do and all the mitzvahs. What if you want to do something extra special? You're doing the regular stuff and now you want to go a little closer. You're extra thankful you recovered from cancer or you had a baby after a long time of lowered fertility or infertility. Or you did something really wrong and you want to apologize for it. You need some kind of extra spiritual thing that's not just a regular run-of-the-mill mitzvah keeping. One could choose to become a Nazirite. So a Nazirite is somebody, male or female, who takes a vow of being a Nazirite for a minimum of 30 days and a maximum of multiple years. But it's time. I think you can take the vow on for life. But most people took it on for a certain specific period of time. And the vow included not cutting your hair. I mean, this is the definition of being a Nazirite. Not cutting your hair. Not having any grape products. So no fresh grapes, no raisins, no wine. And not becoming tamei meit, not coming into contact with a dead body. Let's say you went to a party and there was a fruit punch on the table, and you took a glass of it. And somebody said, what do you think of my punch? I colored it naturally by using grape juice. And you're like, right? So you realize you drank grape juice while you're a Nazirite, right? Or you happen to walk into somebody's house, and somebody had a heart attack and died right there, and now you're in the house and with the roof over you, and you are now tamei meit, right? So you couldn't help it, but by mistake, here you are, and you, while you're in the middle of your vow, something happens to you, you have to restart the whole count. So if you can, you vowed 30 days and this happens on day 29, you start again and count another 30. Or if it was years, you start again and you count on.
On Carter Boulevard and Hamden, there's a Church of the Nazarene.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, is there any relationship?
That is to Jesus of Nazareth.
Right, that's Jesus of Nazareth.
It has nothing to do with
the city.
Okay.
Right. No, that's a good question. My husband wants to open a kosher cheese store featuring Israeli cheeses, and he would call it Cheeses of Nazareth. So
you have everybody coming in there.
Right.
The Christian and the Jews.
Right. I'll put that next to his kosher Italian store, sub store, which will be called Hero Israel.
Hero Israel.
So, anyway, yeah, that's the Nazarenes from the city Nazareth, which who knows, maybe it has something to do. I'm not sure if there's a connection, but the word is similar. So, but a Nazir, let's see, Nazir is different than the Hebrew word is Nitzrat. So it's a Tzadi and a Zayin, so it's different roots. Nazir with a Zayin and Nitzrat, the city Nazareth, is a Tzadi. Okay, so anyway, after they finish the whole thing. They shave their head, offer their hair on the altar, whatever that means. I don't know if you burn it or whatever, there's ceremony with that. And they have to bring a sin offering. So here they are abstaining this whole time from these three things. And now, and because they want to either be thankful or say I'm sorry about something that's outside the norm, and now they have to bring a sin offering. What's that about? So that's about the fact that we Jews are not ascetics. That's not our normal path. We're supposed to engage in the physical and use the physical to become more spiritual. We're not supposed to abstain from the physical that's permitted, that whatever physical is permitted. So here, the Nazirite is abstaining from permitted physical things, from permitted wine, and permitted contact, visiting somebody, going to a funeral or whatever, where there's a dead person there, and permitted haircuts. You're allowed to do that. And he takes a, or she takes a vow not to do that. So there's a sin offering in not enjoying those things during that time. So we do have a concept that we're supposed to appreciate the world. I used to hate olives. I thought they were so disgusting. I had to serve them when I was in Israel. You know, breakfast always included olives, and I was the head cook in our army base. And so I got the longest spoon possible to, like, stand far away from the can, scoop them out, put them in a bowl, because they're so disgusting. And then, like, the smell of them or the feel of them, and they squeaked when you put the spoon around them. It was just gross. And then I decided, I see other people like them, and they're one of the seven fruits of the land of Israel, and I wanted to like them. I didn't want to die and go up into heaven, and God will say, so, no, did you like the seven fruits of the land of Israel that I made specially for you to enjoy? And I would say, pomegranates, pretty good, dates, figs, yum, but olives, ugh. So I said, okay, I didn't want to have to say that, so I tried to like olives. And at first I started with little pieces on pizza, with big bites, with tiny pieces, and then slices, and then half olives, and now I love them. I worked on it, because you want to be able to enjoy that which is permitted to you, if possible. Okay, next part of the book, the spies. So here we are, traveling through the desert. We're traveling through the desert for we don't know how long yet. It has not yet been decreed 40 years at this point in our story. Traveling, because we do need to shake off the dust of slavery, receive our law in the empty land, create our culture before we go into the land of Israel. Right? So we're going into the land of Israel for a specific purpose, which hopefully we'll get to by the end. But meanwhile, we know we're headed towards the land. Right? There's lots of mishaps along the way. But meanwhile, and lots of whining and moaning, complaining on behalf of the Jews, who always have what to say. It's unbelievable, actually, how much we could complain. But we do. Anyway, now it's time to possibly go into the land. So a reconnaissance mission is assembled. 12 spies, one representative from each tribe. Now you might think, how equitable, how nice, one from each. But actually, our sages teach us it was a sign of mistrust. They needed one from each so that everybody would trust the report of the whole. They really, really could have gotten by with just two to send them in and scope it out and come back with a report, but not every tribe would trust somebody else's representative. So they assembled one for each one, sent all 12 in, and I'm sure you know the story. They came back with giant fruits. That's the picture that's on the Kedem wine bottles, right? Carrying the huge grapes and the huge fruits. So 10 of them came back and said, do you know what? There's giants in the land, and we're never going to be able to conquer it. They're going to squish us like grasshoppers. That's right. And two of them, Yehoshua and Caleb, said, it's fine. We're going to go in there. We're going to do what God said to do. We've been successful with God's help in the past. We'll be successful with God's help in the future, and off we go. But the children of Israel heard the evil report of the spies and lost heart. That was bad news. That actually happened on the ninth day of the Hebrew month of Av. Right? What do? On that day, annually?
We fast
on Tisha B'Av.
Right?
We fast on Tisha B'Av. So the reason why we fast today is because both temples were destroyed on that day, along with other tragedies. However, the energy for that day was implanted at this time. So it was on the ninth of Av when the spies came back, gave the report that Jews became disheartened, and that day through history bubbled into a very negative day for the Jews. It's a day of bad things for the Jews. We created a negative energy, and through each year that negative energy bubbles up in some way, sometimes worse than others, with destructions or expulsions, the Spanish expulsion also. I don't even know if it's true, but I've heard, I should check it out, that the shot that rang around the world was also on the 9th of Av, whenever that started the First World War. Who knows? Bad stuff happened on the 9th of Av throughout history. But this is the first bad thing that happened, was this. So it started up, started the ball rolling. It's at the consequence from this was that God said, oh, you guys lost so much heart that you can't go into the land.
You're not ready.
You are not ready. You're so not ready that only your kids could be ready. We're going to need to distance you by an entire generation. So you're going to have to wander so that all your 20 to 60-year-olds will grow up enough to die, meaning most people died at 60 at that time, right? So everybody has to die off, and then those who weren't yet 20 when this happened, the young, youthful hopefuls, will then grow up, and they'll be able to go in, but not you guys. So every Tisha B'Av, they had to, I guess every eighth of Av, they dug their own grave and went to sleep in. And in the morning, some people woke up, and some people didn't. So the ones who woke up would fill in whoever didn't wake up, and they'd continue with their journey. But they did that until one morning, everybody dug their own graves, and they all woke up. And they knew the 40 years was over, and it's time to go into the land. So that's our story.
Did they have a calendar at that time?
Yes, they must have had a calendar.
You have all these calendar names from the Babylonian gods.
Yes, right,
so
right.
How can that be
possible?
That came
later. No, that came later. They didn't have those names.
But
they had the calendar. They called each month by the first month, second month, third month, like that.
Oh, I see.
Yes. Yeah. Because that was the first mitzvah that we got when we came out of Egypt. In the book of Genesis, right, was this month shall be to you the first of months, and that's the month of Nisan. So now we call it Nisan, but that was called the first month, right? Some people are careful because the Hebrew months, and because we have that mitzvah, that month is the first month. That's Nisan. The month of Passover is the first month. Some people don't write the numbers of the American months, the Gregorian months, because they don't want to count months out. It's not January, it's not the first month. Nisan is the first month. So I write on my checks, I just write Jan, you know, instead of 1, if I can. If it's little boxes, so then I put in the 01. But I try to write the name instead of the number, just to have in mind that I count the months. The first one is Nisan, not the first one is January. Because that is a specific mitzvah. You don't have to do that, it's just something to keep in mind if you want to. Okay, so what are the consequences? 40 years of wandering. 1 year of wandering for each day of the spies' reconnaissance mission. Here's something I don't know if there's a source for. I did read it in a book, and then in another book, I read that there was no source for it in that book. But I like it, so I'm going to share it with you anyway. So a concept in Minyan is that 10 men have to get together to form a prayer quorum. One person, Lisa Aiken in her book, says that comes from here, comes from the spies. That with the spies, 12 men went into the land of Israel, 10 men came back and used their voices to dishearten the people, disillusion the people, create destruction and damage in the people, and the people accepted their voices for negativity and it harmed us. And as a tikkun for that, to fix that, now, groups of 10 men have to get together and use their voices to connect, use their voices to add heart and to create connection. So that's one reason why it's 10 men in a minyan, not 10 people in a minyan, is that it's a guy thing. They went in, they used their voices, they created destruction. Now they have to get together, use their voices, and create connection. So it's a tikkun for them. Okay, now we come up to Korach's rebellion. Korach was a Levi. I have a friend who is the son of a cantor, went through $200,000 worth of Jewish education in New York, and now she's in college at NYU. She's leading a little Parsha group, you know, a Shabbos morning group in the synagogue across the street. She wakes up late. She doesn't remember what the parsha is. She runs into her father, who's a cantor and a big shul, right, and knows a lot. He says, "Dad, quick, tell me what's the parsha. I have to run across the street and teach it." He says, "Okay, it's parsha Korach. This is the parsha in which Korach and his followers rebel against Moshe. And in order to put down the rebellion, Moshe says, show up at an appointed time, and we'll see what happens. And then the earth breaks open, swallows up Korach and all of his people, and swallows them alive, and then all the people see that Moshe is right." She's like, "Dad, quick, I need the real story. I'm late." He's like, $200,000. The summer parsha. They don't learn that in school, so she never heard that story, apparently. That's the real story, okay? So Korach, who's a Levi, says, "Moses, you're a Levi, I'm a Levi. I think I should be in charge. You were in charge long enough." Right? Who says everybody should follow you? I have the same yichus. I have the same parentage as you. I think they should be following me at this point. And so he and his followers get together and make a whole big fuss, and the rebellion does have to be put down. And that is exactly what happens. It's interesting. We have a little hair-covering story here, too. We have Datan, Aviram, and On, the sidekicks of Korach, are the main instigators of this fight, right? On, the third one, has a wife. They all have wives, but On's wife is smart. So she knows that the men are going to come get her husband for the main rebellion the next day. And she does not want her husband to be a part of it. So she doesn't know how to separate her husband from them and protect her husband from that he's going to go with them. So what she does is she sits in front of her tent. This is the Midrash. She uncovers her hair and she starts to brush it in public. And the men that come to get her husband are so shocked at the sight of a woman in public, her hair uncovered, brushing her hair, that they turn and run away, and she protects her husband, and he does not die in the earth swallowing up episode. So anyway, that's the story of On's wife. She used her hair to save him. So the earth does swallow them alive. They don't die in the swallowing. Because it's interesting that later on, when the book of Psalms is written, right, we have a few psalms that say, "Lam natzeach livnei Korach." This is the song of the sons of Korach. Where are the sons of Korach? They're in the bowels of the earth, but they still wrote this song. Somehow it floated up, and King David was able to channel it. We do know that King David wrote the book of Psalms, so we hope that somehow he had some. He wrote a lot of them himself, and some of them were channeled from other people.
You're right about it. How did he get that part of it?
Right, there's some channeling. Some prophecy or prophetic voice that said, this one was written by Adam, this was written by the sons of Korach, and that he was able to like grab those from spiritually out of the air that were written by others. So that's Korach's rebellion. So it was put down, Moses' established power is intact. Directly following this, we have the story of Aaron and his staff. Right, so right after that, just to make the message stronger, because it's clear, Moses, his leadership is intact, the rebels are swallowed into the earth. But now for the positive message, Aaron brings his staff, and all the other heads of tribes bring their staffs, stick staffs, and put them in the Ohel Moed, in the tent of meeting. And the next day, they see that Aaron's staff has blossomed with almond blossoms. And so this is a proof that he is the leader. What's up with that? Almond blossoms blossom first. Right? The almond tree blossoms first from all the trees in the orchard. So if you see the signs of spring, the almond, you go in Israel, you see they have spring songs that talk about the Shkedia Paracha, the almond blossoming. Because the almond tree is the first one to bloom. So Rav Hirsch says, speaking about the other tribes and the other nations, all the trees in the orchard will bear fruit. Just the almond blossoms first. The almond tree blossoms first and leads the way. We're all going to bear fruit, but it's the job of the Jews and the job of that subset within the Jews to lead the way, to be the first, and to be the example. This is how you blossom. This is how you connect. Okay. Next comes the red heifer. This is a ceremony nobody really understands. It's considered one of the conundrums, spiritual conundrums. that it's sort of like that riddle, what gets wet as it dries. You know that riddle? What gets wet as it dries? A towel, right? So it gets wet as it dries, right? So in the same way, the red heifer ceremony is to make somebody who has tumat mates, somebody who has come into contact with the dead body, to make them no longer tummy. However, the person doing the ceremony on them, sprinkling the red heifer is a red cow that doesn't have any hairs that aren't red, that has never had a yoke put upon it, never worked in any way. It's offered on the altar, and then it's burnt, and ashes are mixed with a special water, and then that water is sprinkled upon the person who has come into contact with the dead body on the third day and on the seventh day, and then they go to the mikveh, and they are no longer tamei, but the person who did the sprinkling is weird. It's a whole weird thing. Nobody understands it, and it's considered the quintessential ununderstandable law. So that King Solomon, in his wisdom, couldn't understand the red heifer law. So it's considered, it is the quintessential hoke, ununderstandable law. But that's the ceremony nonetheless. Every few years, you know, there are those who are waiting with bated breath for the third temple. Every few years, once a decade or so, a red heifer is born in Israel. And everybody gets really excited because you have to have a red heifer for this ceremony. You have to have a temple too. Once you have a temple, all of us are tamei mate. You know, we can't get out of that tumah without a red heifer in the ceremony, so everybody gets all excited when they see a red heifer born, and they wait and wait and wait, and then there's like a little white hair, a little black hair, whatever it is, but people get excited when a red heifer is born. Okay, then we have the story of Miriam's death, and the water from the rock. I really should have put that below Miriam's death. Miriam dies. In Miriam's merit, Miriam, the sister of Moses, Miriam and Aaron are the siblings of Moses, Moshe, in Miriam's merit, and it has a lot of symbolism, but a well follows them as they go. It's a magical well that goes with the encampment. Wherever they go, they have water that bubbles up in the merit of Miriam. She dies, and with her, the water supply goes, which helps everybody realize the fountain of sustenance that Miriam was for the people. Spiritual sustenance, which manifested in physical sustenance and refreshment. And we know that water and Torah are compared often. One reason why water and Torah are compared is because water has no shape. It takes on the shape of that which it is poured into, that into which it is poured. And we also are shaped by our character traits, by our midot, which means our measurements. They measure us. So Torah is only as beautiful as that, as the container that it's poured into. So we have to have beautiful character traits to be a beautiful container, so that when Torah is poured into us like water, it takes on the shape of us, which is beautiful, not the shape of us, which might not be. Anyway, so that's Miriam. She dies, the water dries up, and now the people, again, are whining and moaning. Oh, we're so thirsty. You took us in the desert. We could have died a long time ago, and now you brought us in the desert, we're going to die, and again. So God says, don't worry, guys, speaking to Moses and Aaron, who are left. I'm going to give you a little rock. You'll talk to the rock. The rock will give you water. It'll be fine. So they go in front of the people. The rock is there. The people are whining and moaning. It gets on Moses' nerves. And instead of talking to the rock, he hits the rock. Water comes gushing forward. Everybody gets to drink lovely. However, Moses gets in big trouble for this. He definitely stepped outside of the will of God in a public manner. And for that, he is denied entrance into the land of Israel. So here he got the Jews out of Egypt, he led them through the desert, he dealt with their whining and their moaning. He saved them twice, after the sin of the golden calf and after the spies, both times when God said, I've had with this people. I am done with them. I'm going to start with fresh. Moses, it's you and me and your descendants. We're making a new start. And Moses said to God, no. I am with them. So if you wipe them out of your book, wipe me out of your book too, because I go with them. So because of that, and because God appreciated Moses so much, Moses saved the Jewish people twice. And here, after saving them, leading them, and coming to the edge of the land, that's where he's told, sorry, you blew it. So he did. Okay, let's see. Then Aaron dies, also sad. Bilam's donkey and this blessing is only two. I have to hurry up to the end, sorry. There's only two talking animals in the entire Torah. Where are they?
One's a talking donkey.
Yep. And the talking snake, right? Now, it's interesting. We're used to Disney. We see talking animals all the time. Not a problem for us. But think about before Disney, before movies, a talking donkey and a talking snake in a book we're supposed to take seriously. Really. It's very strange. But this really is. There's a whole conversation with the donkey. So it's definitely a talking donkey, and the text doesn't even expect you to be surprised about it. It's a regular conversation, and nobody's fainting over it. Bilam faints from the angel, but not from the talking donkey. That's just a matter of course. He hits the donkey finally after the third time. The donkey says, what are you hitting me for? Haven't I been your faithful donkey all these years and carried you around? He says, yeah, you have. He says, well, what? He says, but you stopped where I wanted to go. He's like, do you think maybe I have a reason for stopping? I saw an angel. So it's just a regular conversation between a man and his donkey. But Bilam is hired by Balak. So Balak watches. Balak's the king of a certain tribe in a little nation. And he's watching the children of Israel moving through the desert, conquering different people along the way, or moving through their territory. And he is nervous. And he gets, this is a different kind of people. They're not normal. We have to fight them in not normal ways. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to hire a sorcerer. And he's going to curse them. And with the curse, then we're going to be able to use our physical might and win. But clearly the physical might alone doesn't work. So I need to bring in the big guns. So he goes to try to hire Bilam. Bilam at first says, no, I can only do this with the blessing of God. And God says, no. Second time they come back, offer him more money, more prestige. And he says, you know, I'll talk to God again. God says, okay, you can go, but you can only say what I tell you to say. He doesn't know yet what he's permitted to say. But he goes on the journey. Meanwhile, he does open his mouth. He tries to curse the Jews, but he can't. It won't come out of his mouth. When he opens his mouth, as he's overlooking the Jewish encampment, he actually says a beautiful thing. How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, with Ma Tovu Ohalecha Yaakov. It's the, we quote this Rasha when we come to the synagogue. And we see how beautiful the tent of the Jews is. The congregation of Israel here in our synagogues, we say it when we walk in. Ma tovu ohalecha. So he sees our families, the building block of our nations, and says, how beautiful are your tents, as he looks out over the encampment and sees each family structure. And he says, what a beautiful group this is. So he gives us a blessing. Then, okay, quick, I'll end with this. There's the journeys along the way. The book basically ends with recounting the 42 cities that the Jews went through in this whole book. It's just an interesting little allusion to Hanukkah. Count them if you want to, or you can trust me, that the 25th station is Hashmona. Hanukkah is on the 25th day of the month of Kislev. This is just a little hint to Hanukkah. And the heroes of Hanukkah are the Hashmonaim. So you have 25 in Hashmona related in this place. Anyway, so they go through the 42 stations, and it's really to remind us, they moved from here, they went to there. They moved from here, they went to there. Just recounts the whole thing. But really, if that's supposed to be headlines, if we would remember the whole book, that's the summary of the whole book. Just reminding us. It doesn't say we went from here, and there was a well, and then we went to there, and there was the golden calf, and we went to there, and there was the mun started there, and we went to here, and then we had the birds that came, and then we went to here. It just reminds you, you know, because you've been through the whole thing. Remember, we went here, just like recounting a road trip. Right? We started out in Rochester, and then we went to Buffalo, we saw Niagara Falls, and then we went to, right? You remember all the things once I tell you the whole trip, and finally we got to San Francisco, and it was over. So that's what's going here. And finally, the land is divided up. There's another census in the end of the book, so they can know proportionally, how big is each tribe? So we know proportionally how much of the land of Israel to give to each tribe. The land is divided up. The Levites, again, get no land, but they get 48 Levitical cities, six of which are
cities of refuge.
Thank you very much. Half are on one side of the Jordan River, half are on the other side. Even though the bulk of the Jews are in the Israel side, the other side of the Jordan River is not actually the Holy Land. But it's better pasture land, and a couple of tribes asked for that. So they're considered not actually as good. those tribes, because they would rather have the better land than the better holiness. There's a higher level of holiness in the land of Israel. So they sacrifice the physical for the spiritual. They sacrifice the spiritual for the physical, which is why the cities of refuge are divided half and half. Even though most Jews are in the land of Israel, there's only three cities of refuge in Israel and three cities on the other side. Cities of refuge are for people who are careless and killed by mistake. Not for premeditated murder, but for a careless person, which really means, if you understand the Torah and how it works, a person had some negative energy because of the way they behaved in some way that allowed their carelessness to then manifest in the death of somebody else. Which means really there's something awry in their spiritual makeup, and they need to go to this city of refuge for a certain period of time. So half of them are where the more materialistic Jews are, and half of them are where the bulk of the Jews, the more spiritual Jews, are. And finally, quickly to end, going into the land, so just a thought on the land. What is the point of the land? Why do we need a state? Here we are a nation, we have our tribes, we have our laws, we could stay in the desert, right? We could still do our whole, we'll give God what he needs and what he wants from us, we'll do the offerings and we'll keep the laws and we'll follow him around and we'll get our sustenance from God, however. But God says, no, we don't want this magical existence anymore where I send you food from the sky and water from rocks. You need to go into the land, plow the earth, make your own living. From that living, tithe it, give food to the Kohanim, give food to the Levi'im. The rest you get to keep. But you've got to have all these laws at work in this land. So the point of that is to fulfill our role in the world. A, to engage in the physical, to grow us spiritually, but really, B, to be that beacon unto the world. We're supposed to be a light unto the nations, to the nations. So we have to be a nation in a place with a government and a police department and lawyers and farmers and street sweepers and teachers and musicians and whatever it is that makes a nation. We need to have all of that in our own hunk of land so that we can behave in a way that turns people's heads and says, wow, what makes you like that? But it's in that piece of land that is the convergence of three continents, really. You have Africa and Europe and Asia all converging in that little sliver of land, and then an ocean on the other side, so that all the trade routes basically go through Israel. So that that little chunk, that little tiny people, is the kernel of idea spreading to the planet. As people move through us and see our nation and how we behave and how our government works and how our religion works, they should be taking our ideas and spreading them out into the world, which in fact is what's still happening. Those ideas are still being spread. But the idea is that eventually we should come back to that land and actually actualize that stellar nation presence. We're not there yet, but we're still gathering people, hopefully, and gathering ideas to turn us around so that we should become that stellar shining nation right there on that little piece of land that people should look at us and say, wow, what makes you like that? That way we could be the firstborn and lead the other kids into a connection with our heavenly parent. So that's the idea of this book. Okay, you could ask any questions if you want.